Well, please do pick up a Bible and turn back to Genesis chapter 1, page 1. I'm probably even more relieved than you are that we've got the sound back. Now, we're going to have to listen hard this morning. There are certain aids to it. Our subject is the one that most of us love talking about, ourselves. But its implications are so big, both for ourselves personally and our society, that we've only time just to throw out various seed thoughts. So I hope that we'll have our brains working in highest gear. Let me just say a couple of things before we begin, which is to say that whenever I speak of man this morning, I'm meaning mankind in general. You'll see in verse 27, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them. That is to say, what's written in the verses we're studying applies across the board. That in itself has implications, but it's next week that we'll be looking at the relationship between man and woman. Secondly, I want to say that, as last week, we will be looking forward to the New Testament from time to time to draw out some of the implications of these beginnings that we're studying in Genesis. I think it's important we do that. All of us are aware, aren't they, that beginnings can often have more significance than they appear to have at the time. One of the reasons why we go back to Genesis 1 is to have a look at the foundation of our faith and indeed of ourselves, of our world. We know that who we are today as people has been shaped and molded by where we've come from. We know that in our own individual lives. We also know that the significance of some early events only becomes clear as we grow older. Well, I believe that the true significance of some of these verses in Genesis becomes clearer as the New Testament begins to make God's revelation even more clear. There's always a danger when we come to Scripture, and especially when we come to a chapter like this, that however much we're trying simply to read out of the passage, we actually read things into it. So it's a great check, isn't it, to see where the New Testament puts its emphasis, what it's read out of our beginnings and out of God's purposes. Now, having said that, let me plunge straight in to the first point I want to make this morning, and the most obvious one as we come to look at verses 26 and 27, that man is created in God's own image. When we read these verses, certain things are immediately clear, aren't they? Then God said, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. Let us make man in our image after our likeness." Well, it's obvious as soon as you say that, isn't it, that man is actually different from God. We are created by him. We share in this chapter the same setting as other creatures. We were created on the same day as the living creatures of verse 24. Both, as we read on in chapter 2, we'll discover, are made from dust. Now, we're very definitely a creature. And the fact that we're made in the image of God makes it clear we're not God. An image only exists by derivation, doesn't it? An image isn't the original. Indeed, if you didn't have the original, you can't have an image. It's nothing without the original. So, of course, as soon as we come across a New Age emphasis on the divinity of man, we realize that it couldn't be more clearly denied. But actually, it's also strikingly obvious when you read these verses in the context of the whole chapter that the emphasis isn't so much that man is different from God, but that man is distinct from other creatures. For what is peculiar to man is that God made him, made them, in our image. That little phrase occurs three times. Did you notice it? Verse 26. Let us make man in our image. Verse 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Now, whatever that phrase means, it surely marks us off, doesn't it, from all the other creatures. As you read through the chapter, it's clear when you come to this part of the sixth day that we've reached the pinnacle of God's creation. And he uses that special Hebrew word created, which surprisingly he uses very rarely through the chapter. It's only elsewhere in verse 1 and verse 21. He uses it three times in verse 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female, he created them. Yes, this is the climax of the creation saga. A man is a creature, and yet he's significantly distinct from every other creature. Listen again to those words we read earlier from Psalm 8. Yet thou hast made him little less than God, and dost crown him with glory and honor. Thou hast given him dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, and also the beasts of the field, the birds of the air and the fish of the sea, whatever passes along the paths of the seas. Now, we may sometimes stoop to the level of animals, but nothing could be a clearer reminder, could it, than that of the folly of studying the animals and thinking we'll understand man. For whatever our similarities, man is more than either a naked or a trousered ape. Now, let me just apply briefly this thought that man is created in the image of God in three different directions. Firstly, towards God. Now, you see, whatever the precise meaning of the image of God, and Genesis doesn't stop to explain it, does it? The Bible never stops to define it, which is why the commentators have a field day. I think Kidner, very shrewdly, refuses to let us separate and divide our spirit and our mind from our body, insists we're treated as a whole. He speaks of us as some kind of transcript of an eternal, bodiless creator, transcribed into terms of a temporal, bodily creature. And he illustrates it in his usual pithy way by speaking, it's a bit like trying to transcribe an epic into a sculpture, or a symphony into a sonnet. Whatever the precise meaning, it's clear that God is not wholly other than us. Not as if there's no connections. Last week we warned, didn't we, against having too intimate or personal a view of God, for he is our sovereign creator who stands outside of his creation. Well, this week I want to emphasize the other side of the coin. Don't forget that he has created us for this extraordinary relationship with him. And however strong our rebellion, there are still ties between us. Surely that's what accounts for the way Paul handles this idea when he's preaching to the Athenians. If you like traveling through the Bible and it keeps you alert, turn forward to Acts chapter 17. It's page 130 in the New Testament sections. Here he is in the middle of the Areopagus, proclaiming the Christian God to the bright sparks of Athens. And he seems to be rooted in Genesis 1. As they don't have the foggiest about who God is, so he wants to try and make things clear to them. He speaks about the God who, verse 26, made from one every nation of men. Who, verse 27, made men that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel after him and find him. Yet he's not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your poets have said. For we are indeed his offspring. And he reiterates that, being then God's offspring. Now, we can make more of that sentence than the rest of the New Testament allows us, but we mustn't make less than the New Testament gives us here. Paul, you see, is immediately putting the barriers down, isn't he, on a view of God that makes him so other and distant and remote and impersonal. We mustn't allow that. He made us in his image. Being then God's offspring, he's able to say. Well, there's one application towards God. Secondly, an application towards ourselves. As we come back to Genesis, we must view ourselves in the light of verses 26 and 27. That is to say, we mustn't see ourselves too highly. We are only made in the image of God, but we mustn't see ourselves too lowly either. And I want to emphasize that this morning. For there are so many in our society, aren't there, who are not only depreciated, but can do nothing but depreciate themselves. They have a low self-esteem that actually has nothing to do with Christian humility. Everything to do with an incorrect value of themselves. For they've lost touch with their roots. And there's a measure in which, as evangelicals, we do need to be careful. We can encourage this in wrong ways. Sometimes we may be too quick even to speak of sin and rebellion. Or we can draw the wrong conclusions from it. You know that hymn, I was trying to look it up this morning, and as usual, when you can remember last lines, you can never remember first lines. But it ends like this. It speaks of the two things that all stick in the hymn writer's mind. It says, the wonder of God's love to me and my own worthlessness. Now, that's not right, is it? My own unworthiness, yes. But not my worthlessness. God made us in his image. Indeed, the New Testament speaks of our worthlessness by adding that God's redeemed us, of course, through his Son's death. Now, there are many, many people to whom we need to restore their roots. Last application of the idea that we're made in the image of God for this morning is as we apply that truth to others. For how we treat people depends on how we think of them. Created in the image of God applies to mankind. And again, however much the fall and sin has marred it, that image still remains. And the Bible urges us to treat people in the light of it. There's a warning later in Genesis that those who shed the blood of man shall have their blood shed because man's made in the image of God. And James, when he writes in the New Testament in chapter 3, don't look this one up, but just listen carefully. He makes it clear that man still has dominion, can tame every kind of beast, but no human being can tame one thing, and that's the tongue. A restless evil, full of deadly poison, and listen how he illustrates it. With it we bless the Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who are made in the likeness of God. Beware how we treat and speak of others, the Bible warns us. For still today, in spite of all our rebellion, we're to remember each other's origins. However much of a caricature we've become, we are made in the image of God. And that will be a sobering thought. For us and the individuals, however disagreeable that we bump into through the week, and, of course, for groups. We treat groups sometimes disparagingly, don't we? Ethnic groups, social groups, racial groups. Men treat women like that. Sometimes the reverse even happens. Employers treat employees with scant regard. Big business treats the small investor as if he or she doesn't matter. President Saddam needs to remember it with his guests, the IRA with their victims. Man, created in the image of God. Secondly, man created to have dominion over God's world. Verse 28. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. Well, one writer has picked up this theme, this job description for man, and seen as well how that reflects us being made in the image of God. He says this, just as an image or statue in the temples of the ancient world was a vivid reminder to the worshippers of the absent God, so man seems commissioned in Genesis 1 to be a reminder to the universe of divine government, and is thus God's representative on earth. The chapter clearly presents mankind in royal terms, with a divine mandate to rule God's creation as his representative. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion. I take it we must take things as a whole. There is a theology around that seems to put a full stop after be fruitful and multiply and make endless childbearing an obligation. But at some stage, I imagine, we fill the earth. We have here, don't we, a clear link between man and creation. We're made as captain of it. The world is linked to mankind. So when man rebels, the world suffers. And when God restores what he's restoring, we discover is both man and the world, the earth. But we're to subdue it. We're to have dominion. They are strong words. They imply there is quite a task in front of us. And the position man has, you see, is of both steward and master. It means, I take it, that we will indeed have to give account for our ecological sins, for our environmental selfishness. We're not free to do what we like with the world. Indeed, doing what we like isn't always a good way of subduing it. But I take it as well that we're not to carry some of the environmental positions to the extremes that they can get to, and indeed to some of the pantheistic extremes. That there is something awfully wrong, isn't it, and quite unjustifiable from these verses, of a situation, say, in India, where you might have starving people while sacred cows roam the streets. I take it that from these verses, not every tree has to be preserved. I say that with no reference to Islington. Now, what do we learn from this position we have as dominion, created to have dominion over God's earth? Well, again, let me take two sides of what I believe is the same coin. Two truths to learn from this. Firstly, creation was not made to run on automatic pilot. See, there are things we can learn about God's creation from this command to man. God's creation in Genesis 1 was not every gardening incompetent's dream. That is to say, it wasn't designed to produce automatic blooming and fruitfulness. For man had to subdue the earth. Adam, when he's put in the garden in the next chapter, we'll discover, chapter 2, verse 15, was put there to till it and to keep it. I need to bear that in mind, don't I, when I understand what was meant when God saw the world and saw that it was very good. God has so made things that they need man's cooperation if planet Earth is to be productive. Seems the clear implication from these early chapters of Genesis. You know, there's a corny old story, but it's full of truth, of the Cockney gardener who'd produced this splendid garden and was showing his vicar around it one day, and every time he pointed out some new rare flower and how pretty it was, the vicar went into sort of ecstasies and thanked God for it and said, "Hey, wasn't God wonderful to have made flowers like this?" And the more the vicar went on, the more frustrated and angry the Cockney got, and finally got fed up with God getting all the credit. So he turned to the vicar and he said, "You should have seen this here garden when God had it all to himself." Well, he's got a truth, hasn't he? And a truth we're wise not to ignore. Without man, the earth will not be subdued. That's how it was made. Luther said, "God even milks the cow through you." See, creation doesn't run on automatic pilot in that sense. Here's the other side of that same coin. It means that man was not made for a sun lounger. See, the Bible's picture of paradise and ours aren't necessarily the same. Man wasn't created to lie back with a cool drink and enjoy an armchair view. Enjoy, yes. But to subdue, to till, to keep. Man was created creative. Man was created to work. Dorothy Sayers may be known to most of us as just a thriller writer, but she was also something of a theologian, and she once wrote this: "Work isn't primarily a thing one does to live, but that one lives to do." Well, if you've any experience of the dehumanizing effects of unemployment, you'll see how that observation of life bears out what Genesis is saying. Now, we need to distinguish between work and unemployment, or rather work and employment, being paid for it. If you've any problems, any mother or housewife will fill you in. But it is a Christian, isn't it? Not just a liberal with a small L. It's a Christian, not just a liberal reaction, to be appalled at the dehumanizing effects of unemployment. See, when we treat man as if the world can run without him, it is dehumanizing. We were made to be involved in the subduing of the earth and to have dominion over it. So don't moan too much tomorrow morning when it's back to the office. Now let me put it more positively, or at least let the Bible put it more positively. Ecclesiastes, the writer to it, still echoes this sense of fulfillment through toil as the best possible scenario under the sun. Again, don't turn it up, but listen just to what he's got to say. "There's nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. I saw that there's nothing better than that a man should enjoy his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him?" Now, before you form a queue to tell me at the end how unfulfilling your labor is, there is, of course, a frustration and a futility that creation has been condemned to in judgment on our rebellion, that we'll have to face in a few weeks' time when we reach Genesis chapter 3. And we must realize we live in a world that has got that futility. But it may not have come through your paid employment. I suspect all of us know something, don't we, of that satisfaction of a job done. That if even if you're as limitedly creative as I am, there is that great sense of achievement. Why, we were made for that. There's nothing wrong in feeling that joy and that satisfaction. Created to have dominion of God's world. Thirdly and lastly, See, there's implications for who we are. There's implications for what we do. Now, here's implications for our perspective on life. Created to enjoy God's rest. It's chapter 2. The more I look at this, the more the chapter division is quite extraordinary, isn't it? I find it harder and harder to work out why anyone bothered to put the beginning of chapter 2 where they have done. We haven't finished the week. Look, you want to end chapter 1 as they do at the end of the sixth day, and suddenly you discover chapter 2 is carrying on exactly where you've left off. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work which he'd done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he'd done. So God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it, because on it God rested from all his work which he'd done in creation. It is most extraordinary to divorce it from the rest of the creative week. And it's lethal to our understanding of ourselves and God's purposes if we close our Bibles at the end of chapter 1. Now, this seventh day is firstly God's rest. It's described in terms of what God did. It's a rest by the way of achievement, not a rest of inactivity. It's a rest because he's finished a job. He's well done, very well done in fact. But he does continue to sustain the world he's created. When we said earlier in the Creed, I believe in God the Father, the Almighty, the word for the Almighty literally comes from a word for ruler. Ruler of the creation he's made. Sovereign because he's not just creator, but sustainer. He hasn't just wound it up like some clockwork toy and will let the world slowly unravel. It's not inactivity, it's not exhaustion either. He is ceaselessly active. Indeed, when Jesus is involved in great controversies about work on the Sabbath, he makes it plain that his Father is working still. For this seventh day, you'll notice, has no end. It's the one day, at least, on which we need to be agreed, does not consist of merely 24 hours in these early chapters of Genesis. No, it's a rest because he'd finished creating. But this rest also, it seems by clear implication here, and it's made explicit, as we'll see, is for sharing. On the seventh day, God finished his work which he'd done, and he rested on the seventh day from all the work which he'd done. Verse 3, so God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it, set it apart. Why? Why do that? Why does he need to do that? Well, not for his sake, but for others. For now, do turn this reference up. Turn on to Exodus chapter 20, will you? It's page 65. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 8. Remember the Sabbath day, the rest day. The word for Sabbath has got the same root as the word in Genesis, which keeps the verb, which keeps speaking of God resting. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. That's actually the hard bit, isn't it? But the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, and then there's a list to make that spell that out. But notice now verse 11. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Now, do you see, God set apart the seventh day, but we, verse 8 of Exodus, we don't set it apart, we're to remember it and to keep it. See, as I read Exodus, it becomes clear, doesn't it, that in Genesis 1 and 2, I have the archetype, the pattern for our working week. Sabbath was made for man. For it becomes clear that the work of 6 days isn't all there is to life, and the seventh has been given so that we shouldn't be absorbed by subduing the earth. There's more to man than that. And we ignore it at risk to our physical well-being, says he shamefacedly. History reinforces God's wisdom, by the way. You probably know that at various times people have tried to change the pattern of the working week. The French Revolution, I believe, introduced a 10-day working week. That didn't last for more than a few years. And the Russian Revolution abolished Sunday as a day of rest. If you've ever wondered what you can give thanks to Stalin for, it can be that he reintroduced Sunday as a day of rest. It lasted no longer than that. But now let me just add one more thing to this. For when I say we're created to enjoy God's rest, we need to understand as we go through the Bible, we discover that the rest keeps the remaining tantalizingly in the future. For the New Testament, the concept of Sabbath and rest is still pregnant with meaning. Turn right forward to the other reading we had, page 204 in the New Testaments, Hebrews chapter 4. Now, it may have seemed slightly obscure. It's a difficult passage, and yet certain basic outlines are very clear. The writer is speaking of a rest, of God's rest, and a rest which, according to verse 1, can still be entered. In the previous chapter, chapter 3, he'd been quoting things that God said about the wilderness wanderings of the Israelites, where entering his rest seemed to be equated with entering the promised land. But in chapter four, it becomes clear that this rest is more than God's day at the end of creation. It's more than the promised land. It's something which can still be spoken of and entered into. It is indeed nothing short of God's heaven. You see, the seventh day in creation is a pointer to God's new creation and man's ultimate destiny and purpose. For that's where ultimately we will enjoy God's rest. Now, on your way back to Genesis, stop off for our last cross-reference in Deuteronomy chapter 5. It's page 160 of the Old Testament section. I'm saying this more confidently than I am in a position to think it, because I haven't actually found this anywhere else. But it's something that's often puzzled me, and this could be the solution to it. You'll see here that in Deuteronomy 5, we've got the Ten Commandments reiterated. And in chapter 5 and verse 12, we come to the commandment on the Sabbath. Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy, as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. Verse 15 comes to the reason for it. And of course something will strike you immediately, and that is that a different reason is given. You shall remember that you were a servant in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out thence with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. That's striking, isn't it? The reason that's given is not creation, but redemption. That you're a rescued people. See, in Exodus, it's a day that's set apart for the God who made us to this pattern. In Deuteronomy, it's a day that's set apart for the God who's redeemed us for his promised land. The Sabbath was made for man. Don't be so absorbed in work that you forget your Redeemer and his promised land. We live in a time when Groups like the Lord's Day Observance Society have largely been thrown out of the window, even by the Christian public. And indeed, there's still many points where they need to make their case more clearly, if it's to hold together. But one thing is crystal clear, isn't it? That 7 days spent on accountancy or stockbroking or legal or medical cases will easily lead us to forget our Redeemer and his heaven. Indeed, it's more than likely that that won't be our destination if that's how we're spending our time. For the writer to the Hebrews said this, "While the promise of entering his rest remains, let us fear lest any of you be judged to have failed to reach it." Why, if I'm so absorbed in this world, what makes me think that the new creation is my destiny? Man was made to enjoy God's rest, both in the present and the future. It's with great skill, I believe, that the writer of Genesis draws up this account of our beginnings, and the seventh day relativizes days 1 to 6. We ignore that perspective. At our peril, indeed our eternal peril. Actually, though there's only time to sketch this in, I want to suggest that there's a danger that we overemphasize some of the conclusions we draw about work these days from Genesis chapter 1. But let me leave you with this seed thought, that when you come to the New Testament and look at ideas of subduing and overcoming and conquering and ruling, they're applied to the Christian in terms of living the new creation life, or enjoying our position in heaven with Christ. The New Testament is adamant that we must work. We must work to live and to feed ourselves. But I found it difficult to see where it draws back to Genesis 1 in the way some do, as they teach it today. Man, created in the image of God. Now, does that affect the way we think about God and ourselves and others? Man, created to have dominion over God's earth. Why does that affect our sense of purpose and what life is for? Man, created to enjoy God's rest. How does that govern how we pattern our living? Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father and our Sovereign Lord, you know how quickly our selfish natures get ourselves out of perspective. We pray in your mercy that you'd so take your word home to us that we might live as you truly made us to live, and that in your Son Jesus we might be conformed to that image that we were made to bear. For his name's sake, amen.